Welcome to Profiles. This is Patrick O'Mara. Today's guest is Ambassador Thomas Hubbard. Ambassador Hubbard was U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Korea and has also served in many interesting places around the world, including the Philippines, Malaysia, and in addition was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He's an expert on Asia, and we're delighted, Ambassador Hubbard, to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin with a little bit about you, if you wouldn't mind. You've become a diplomat.
Yes.
When you were in college, did you think you would end up being a diplomat?
I went to college planning to become a lawyer. While in college, I made my first trip abroad, actually to Italy. We had kept an Italian exchange student in my family when I was younger, and I went to visit his family, and I discovered I liked the world. It was fun out there. I discovered I could learn languages. I learned some Italian, and so I went back saying I'll either go to law school, or if by some miracle I pass the Foreign Service exam, I'll join the Foreign Service, and the miracle happened.
And your experience grew. Where was your first appointment?
First posting actually was Latin America, the Dominican Republic.
And
I chose that actually because I'd been to Europe. I hadn't been anywhere else. And I said, okay, let's try Latin America.
And then from there?
From there, I wound up going to Asia, studying Japanese. And Asia became the focus of most of the rest of my career, with the exception of a four-year posting in Paris at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. I spent the rest of my career either in Asia or working on Asia.
Right. Very interesting. Let's talk a bit about South Korea.
Right.
I'm always interested because, of course, Indiana University has many graduates.
Mm-hmm.
A large number of our Jacobs School of Music students are from South Korea,
mm-hmm.
and I visited several times. This must have been a very interesting appointment for you. Were you there at a time of change? I think you were, if I remember correctly.
Well, I was there from 2001 to 2004, and that, of course, was a time of great change throughout the world. I, in fact, arrived as ambassador in Seoul precisely at the moment of 9/11, 2001, which was exactly the same time the buildings were going down in New York and the Pentagon was exploding. So, you know, I was there for this tremendous turning point in U.S. foreign policy and U.S. history and the world history. So it was a very interesting time.
But you also dealt with a couple of crises whilst
right.
you were there.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, a U.S. Army pilot was captured after his helicopter was shot down over North Korea.
That had actually happened much earlier. 2001 was the first time I was actually
right.
based in Korea. I had worked very much on Korean affairs at the beginning of the Clinton administration in the early 90s. And so this helicopter incident happened in,
uh-huh.
in 1994, where I was working out of Washington at
right.
that point when I was deputy.
Tell me about the incident.
What actually happened is that a small U.S. military helicopter piloted by two young warranted officers slipped accidentally about 20 miles inside North Korea in the middle of the winter. So it was in very snowy conditions. And one of the crewmen was killed in the air, and the other was taken prisoner. And it happened that former Congressman Bill Richardson, more recently known as governor of New Mexico and presidential candidate, he happened to be flying into North Korea from Beijing just as this happened. And he managed to get the body of the deceased pilot out. But after about a week, I was sent in to try to arrange the release of the surviving pilot, which I did successfully. The backdrop for that was that we had been in direct negotiations with the North Koreans since early 1993 on something called the Agreed Framework, which was intended to end their nuclear weapons program. So we were in a mode then when the North Koreans wanted friendship with the United States. This incident threatened that, and fortunately they recognized the importance of resolving it quickly.
Good. Let's talk a bit about South Korea.
I'm sure.
Always impressed when I look at the statistics on South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Comparisons have been made about South Korea's economic growth. In the 50s, it was on a par with most underdeveloped nations, and then
right.
you saw this
mm-hmm.
dramatic increase Was that evident to you on a day-to-day basis as ambassador?
Well, when I was ambassador, it had pretty much happened. They had – the economic miracle had occurred, and actually I went in shortly after the financial crisis that hit Asia in 1997-98, and they were recovering very rapidly from that. But no, the change that has happened in South Korea over the years is absolutely dramatic. I tell a story, if I can digress for a minute. I first went to South Korea with my wife in 1970. Just as a tourist. I was assigned in Japan. We went over to Korea to see what it was like. And we arrived in Busan and found there was a, you know, it was a third world country. You found black markets in the middle of the city and all of that, poverty all around. Most striking was there were almost no trees anywhere. And they had just built a new superhighway going from Busan to Seoul, which everybody considered a white elephant at the time, which was absolutely empty. Mm-hmm. That was 1970. By the time I went back to that same place, the change was just enormous. There were trees everywhere. South Korea carried out one of the most successful reforestation programs in the world. That one superhighway had become multiple superhighways, all jam-packed with traffic, and Busan, like Seoul, was a vibrant modern city. So, you know, Seoul went from having a per capita income that was roughly equivalent to that of Ghana in 1955, about $500, up to a point where, they've been pushing at the 20,000 per capita income mark over the past several years.
It was one of the Asian tigers.
One of the tigers, the first, you know, of the Japan, of course, was first, but the countries that moved fastest after that were probably South Korea and Taiwan.
It would be important for us to also take into account the current world financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And I'd be interested to know your impressions of the effects on the Korean economy of the current crisis. I've seen statistics that indicate trade has dropped by 30%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's been an effort at some sort of stimulus, I'm sure, in Korea. But mm-hmm. how do you read this current economic crisis?
Well, South Korea, like all of the export-oriented economies of Asia, has been hit very hard. Surprisingly, they haven't quite gone into recession. In the first mm-hmm. quarter of this year, they grew by 0.001% or something like that. So they haven't quite fallen back as far as we have. But they are heavily dependent on exports and very dependent on exports to China, the United States, and to Japan. And we've all fallen backwards in recent months. Interestingly, it's a point I'd like to make about South Korea. For many, many years, South Korea was considered one of the most closed economies in Asia. Their reaction to the financial crisis of the 97-98 was the right one, to open up the mm-hmm. economy, to try to modernize, move up the technology ladder, et cetera. And they were successful in doing that. They have been knocked back a bit now. But they see, interestingly, further opening of their economy as the way out of this crisis. And one of the means they want to do that with is through a free trade agreement with the United States.
And with Europe, I think.
And with Europe. But, you know, their priority is with the U.S. We have signed a free trade agreement, which, incidentally, is very good for both countries. It would lead to an increase in U.S. exports of about $11 billion per year. It would add some $10 billion to U.S. GDP. It would open up markets in Korea for a very wide range of U.S. products. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it calls for a lot of these market opening measures that the South Koreans see as a key to their own recovery.
And that's an important change for them in some way.
That is an important change. That agreement has been signed by both governments. It's awaiting approval by the Korean National Assembly and by the U.S. Congress.
What about China in terms of its economic growth, in terms of its market share, in terms of world markets? Korea is probably feeling a little bit uncertain about its future, given what's happening in China economically.
Well, actually, it's been good for Korea that the Korea has produced a lot of the sort of intermediate goods that are shipped into China and then turned into final products. And so 2 or 3 years ago, China surpassed the United States as Korea's largest export market, mm-hmm. and we will expect that to remain that way.
And so it is able to produce the sort of software, hardware, whatever is necessary.
That's right.
For China, and that and Korea is very strong in terms of this.
Yeah, what tends to happen is a Korean company like LG or Samsung will make some of the basic elements of their product in Korea and then send it off to China for final processing, et cetera. And then ultimately these become exports to the United States from China.
Right. So, yeah. And Samsung, of course, is one of the world's most powerful companies mm-hmm. in
That's
this
right.
regard and so many of the electronic areas.
Exactly. Yeah.
How about President Lee?
Mm-hmm.
Popularity has been up and down. How would you rate him as a president?
I know him well. He's a good friend. He was mayor of Seoul when I was ambassador. President Lee is Korea's first businessman president, first former CEO to become president. In the past, they've had politicians and generals, but not business people. He's conservative in the Korean context. He's a strong leader. He had some problems early in his administration that set back his popularity quite a bit. I think every new president has to change when he becomes president. And I think President Lee, as mayor of Seoul, was sort of accustomed to saying, "I want this done, that done," and it happens. When you're president, you've got to work to maintain your public support as you try to make things happen.
Right.
And he perhaps got out a little too far in front of public opinion and suffered in that way. He is a staunch friend of the U.S. He had a very good relationship with President Bush, and now he's developing a very good relationship with President Obama. He's a very, very competent man.
How about his predecessor? How do you compare the two of them?
Well, they're very different in terms of their political philosophy. President Nguyen, came out of he was a human rights lawyer, a labor lawyer, came out of sort of the leftist camp, much more prepared to reach out to the North Koreans without expecting much in return in the interest of peace and stability in his country. One difference under President Lee is that he has been demanding much more reciprocity, has demanded that the North give, in exchange for assistance from the South. And so there's been some tension in the North-South relationship.
What about U.S. bases? Mm-hmm. That's a topic we hear a great deal about. Given President Lee's friendship with the United States, there's going to be some renegotiation, I assume?
No. What we started under the Nguyen administration at U.S. Request and instigation, a reorganization of our military presence designed to move our troops back somewhat from the front line with the North Koreans, to devolve more responsibility to the South Koreans for handling the ground threat from the North, designed to put our troops in positions where we're more able to bring to bear our technological advantage in reconnaissance, intelligence, and sophisticated forms of warfare. So that process started under Nguyen and Bush and will continue under Obama. We're in the process of moving most of our forces to the southern part of South Korea, south of the Han River that divides Seoul from the rest of the South, and reducing the numbers of our troops from when I first went to Korea in 2001, we had 36,000. We're going down to 28,005.
Symbolic or real?
Both.
The necessity to maintain the bases.
That's right. And I don't think if you take a poll in South Korea, you'll find that at least 85% of the public wants to keep the bases. The South Koreans have sought really is a greater sense of justice that somehow when accidents happen, somebody is held responsibility, but they want to keep the bases. And from our perspective, too, we recognize the need to continue to be there for deterrence against North Korea. And our South Korean bases are useful to us in maintaining our presence throughout the region.
For the region as well as the North Korean issue.
That's right.
It's an interesting question, isn't it, when an incident occurs? I wonder if you'd expand on that a bit. Where would jurisdiction lie in something like that?
What we have every place in the world where we have military personnel is something called a status of forces agreement. And that spells out questions of jurisdiction. If an accident or a crime occurs, who has jurisdiction? And the basic demarcation line is that if a crime or accident occurs when that person is on duty, then we have jurisdiction and they're prosecuted through the U.S. military system. If it happens when they're off duty, the South Koreans, for example, have the right to carry out any judicial procedures if they choose to do so. Often, if it's a minor traffic accident or something, they will say, hey, you know, this happened off duty, but you know, we'll let you handle it. It's not a serious thing. This question, you know, the issue in this particular incident was the personnel were obviously on duty. Because they were going to an exercise in their a military vehicle, and the South Koreans, you know, sort of acknowledged that, but they thought it was a terrible crime because there were two deaths involved, and so many South Koreans said we ought to be able to try these people, you know, because the crime was so serious. In the event, the question became in the U.S. system whether there was criminal negligence involved, and the U.S. military court concluded that there was not. It was a terrible, tragic accident, but you know, no one was criminally at fault. Of course, the South Koreans were very upset with that verdict. They felt somebody should have been held responsible, and there followed a good deal of demonstrations, so-called candlelight vigils, a lot of anti-American sentiment.
One of the things that's sensitive in talking about another part of the world is the notion of graft.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think as we have a viable discussion about South Korea, it would be useful to at least touch on this. Mm-hmm. Some presidents have been accused of this. Mm-hmm. There are many explanations that people give of graft. I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of the realities, the distinction between gift-giving and graft. Mm-hmm. And I've also heard arguments that the lobbying approach that is so much a part of the American system doesn't exist in Korea, and it's a different protocol, as it were, in terms mm-hmm. of how people approach government. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd really like to hear from you, after your extensive experience in Korea, about how do you regard this notion of graft in a society like that?
Well, I think it's probably more relevant to talk about how they regard this notion of graft, and I think the South Korean approach to corruption has changed through the years. For much of the post-war period, South Korea was a military dictatorship, and getting things done in South Korea involved a great deal of government patronage. You know, I like to give, if we've got just a second on this subject, I'd like to give to a little comparison here between South Korea and the Philippines, and why one succeeded much better than the other. If you remember Park Chung-hee in Korea and Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines came to office at virtually the same time. I think it was 1965 or 66. At that time, the Philippines was second only to Japan in its development and the state of the level of its economy. And Korea was still down at the Ghana level at about 500 a year. Park took power by a military coup. Marcos was actually elected the first time he came to office, maybe even the second time. Only later, both of them became very definitely dictators. Park was out. His objective was to develop his country. And so while some of the money was spread in ways that we might not consider appropriate in the United States, he took the Japanese aid money that followed, that came when they normalized relations after World War II, and built a modern steel industry with it. He personally picked and helped develop firms that, like Samsung, like LG and the other winners, and in fact developed them to the national interest. In the Philippines, Marcos was out to steal what he could from his country. And so instead of building viable companies and business leaders, he built a coterie of cronies became the epitome of crony capitalism. He took from the country, whereas Pac, in effect, gave to the country. And by the time the both of them emerged from the dictatorship in the 1980s, Korea was on the road to being one of the most successful countries in the world, and the Philippines had lost its place in the firmament and has never recovered it. So that's a good example of the role of corruption. I think in Korea's most corrupt era was in that transition from Park Chung-hee to free elections when a succession of generals was in office. And I think in a way they built their support by passing around money. They were also receiving it. And both President Chun Doo-hwan and President Noh Tae-woo were convicted after leaving office for graft. Right. And the first kind of politician elected as President Kim Il-sung was also convicted of fairly massive corruption. And now, sadly, we see the former president, Noh Myung-hun of Korea, has been charged with a far smaller scale of corruption involving some loans to his so-called loans to his wife and family members.
She's been implicated.
So it's sad. But I think the scale is greatly reduced, and I think history will go back and say probably that Noh Myung-hun administration was the least corrupt that they've seen in Korea.
And it's quite remarkable that it's so public. This is not an issue that is skirted around.
Well, if you look at South Korea has in one way or another prosecuted almost all of its former presidents. There is an accountability there that we don't often see. I once commented to President Bush that being an ex-president of Korea is a risky business.
And indeed, I recently was aware that the president of Samsung, President Lee,
that's right,
is no longer acting in an official capacity because of certain accusations.
One of the things that has happened is that those family corporations, the so-called chaebol in Korea, the conglomerates, mm-hmm. Set up by very very energetic leaders that were identified by Park Chung-hee, as you pass to the next generation and the next generation, they change quite a bit. Samsung as a conglomerate must be one of the largest companies in the world. They control about 25% of the South Korean economy. Their activities range from electronics to hospitals to housing to
it's enormous.
Road construction in almost everything. And many of these subsidiary companies, for example, Samsung Electronics is a public company with that sometimes as high as 40% foreign share owners. But these families are still controlling these huge conglomerates with very small shares of the overall company. And what's happening now in Samsung is, as I understand it, is the CEO that recently gave up his position but is still largely controlling the company has been trying to pass it along to his son. And doing various stock manipulations to make that happen. The same thing happened within Hyundai Motor Company, where you're approaching one of these generation changes. The second generation is already there, and they're trying to go to the third and maintaining
the transition
that.
Is taking place.
And so there are things that happen certainly in the corporate world that we don't consider appropriate. But God knows, we've seen a lot in our corporate world too.
So, yes, very much a part.
That's right.
I've had the good fortune to visit some outstanding universities in South Korea, mm-hmm. in Seoul, other places. Incredible research that's being done mm-hmm. in the sciences, in business, mm-hmm. in new technology. What's your impression of the Korean university structure?
It's a very strong undergraduate university system, And the whole Korean education system is very tightly run, very tightly controlled, and I think produced some of the, you know, the brightest young people you'll run into anywhere, whether the subject is music or computer science or the pure sciences. They have not been nearly so effective at the graduate level.
Yes.
And that's both a plus and a minus for Americans and for Koreans. One of the results of this is that most of their almost all of their academic leaders and in fact most of their political leaders have been educated abroad. I used to use in my speeches that 75% of the PhD professors in Korean universities got those PhDs from U.S. universities, and I think that
many from IU,
very many from IU, and from a whole range of universities. So that I mentioned earlier to you, I was amazed to discover there was a graduate an alumni association of some 400 people from the University of Alabama, where I went to school, ranging from professors at Seoul National University to computer venture capitalists. So that has been a very good thing for Korea, because unlike Japan, for example, most of their leaders speak English rather well, have spent time, have been educated in U.S. institutions, and are better able to reach out and deal with the world than you often find in the Japanese corporations, where they've had a much stronger system of graduate education in Japan than they have in Korea.
Ambassador Hubbard, you grew up in different parts of the South. You were born in Kentucky. You were raised in Tennessee and in South Carolina. So maybe we should take a musical interlude at this point. Would you like to hear some jazz?
Of course. That would be delightful.
Would Louis Armstrong be one of your favorites?
That sounds great.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Our guest today is Ambassador Thomas Hubbard, who served for several years as the U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Korea. We've been talking about South Korea, and now I'd like to move to discuss North Korea for a bit, if we may.
Mm-hmm. That's a very different subject.
It's a very different subject, and I'm going to lead in with a phrase that everyone has heard of, the axis of evil.
Right.
Mm-hmm. How do you interpret this phrase, axis of evil?
Well, I was ambassador to Seoul when I first heard that phrase, when President Bush used it in his State of the Union message in 2002. And to be honest, I was absolutely appalled. Because I did not know how to explain that statement to the South Koreans. Whatever meaning that statement had to Americans, and I think it was a little hard for Americans to parse the concept also, to the South Koreans it was a very, our allies in South Korea, it was a very disturbing statement. First, because they very much wanted the U.S. to be engaged in dialogue and peaceful negotiations with the North Koreans. The North Koreans had been reluctant to come to talks, and they thought, well, you know, the North Koreans now have lost face, having been called a member of the Axis of Evil. How are they ever going to come and talk to the United States? That was one problem. I think a second problem was what they heard was potential conflict, potential war. If you recall, when this phrase was used, the U.S. was already planning to invade Iraq militarily, had not started yet, but that was in the air. And the South Koreans, you know, thought they heard U.S. intentions to invade North Korea, and that made them very nervous because of the impact that could have on the South. So, and I also wondered how the North Koreans would take it. Would they hear? Certainly, they would be insulted, but would they also hear war? And would that, you know, be an inducement for them to slow down their nuclear weapons program and other activities, or would that spur them to go farther? And so I think to give President Bush credit, I think he stopped using that phrase very soon thereafter. He visited Seoul a couple of weeks after that statement. The South Koreans told him that they were uncomfortable with it, and I don't recall him using that phrase at any time thereafter.
It's a different time and a different place now, with a different Secretary of State and a different president.
Mm-hmm.
We had another partner in the axis of evil, and that was Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And we begin to see some rapprochement, at least readiness to talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are we inching towards that with North Korea?
Well, I would say we're a bit ahead of that with North Korea because, you know, we've been willing to talk to the North Koreans since 1993, when we first began bilateral negotiations with them. There were some ups and downs in getting those talks started again under the Bush administration. I think the Axis of Evil statement played a role in making that difficult. But once we got going, we were engaging effectively with the North Koreans in the so-called six-party talks. Chaired by the Chinese and involving South Koreans, North Koreans, Russians, and our Japanese, and ourselves. And towards the end of the Bush administration, we were supplementing that through fairly effective bilateral discussions. So, you know, I think we've always recognized that talking to the North Koreans is important. North Korea has been a bit ahead of Iran in another respect. That is that they've actually tested a nuclear device, exploded one in October of 2006. A very low yield test, maybe only partially successful, but they have actually exploded a nuclear device, and now have probably enough fissile material to produce another six or eight nuclear devices. Iranians, I think everyone agrees, are in very, you know, sort of mid stage of trying to develop a capacity through a different system to produce fissile material, but they're not there yet.
The six-party talks.
Mm-hmm.
And bilateral talks. So we're dealing with different levels of engagement. Six-party was important apparently also to draw Japan into the into the equation. Would you expand on that a bit?
The key to the six-party talks is that you know, you pull together the countries most directly concerned with North Korea, their neighbors, and each with one thing in common. They don't want nuclear weapons in North Korea. But beyond that, each with somewhat different perspectives and different capacities for influencing the North Koreans, and it's, I think we concluded it was better to have them all engaged with us in the same room than to deal bilaterally with the North Koreans, and
yes,
we achieved some successes that way. But I think it was also clear that the six-party talks alone were not enough to bring the North Koreans around, that in their eyes we were the real threat, the nation they were most concerned about, and that we needed to supplement those multilateral talks with some direct bilateral engagement, which happened in the final 2 years of the administration.
Why does Pyongyang want a nuclear weapon?
Regime survival. I think they mistakenly think that an isolated regime mistakenly thinks that card is the key to their survival, and the trick to any negotiations with North Korea is to convince them that there's a better way. If their real concern is survival, the best way to survive is to develop economically by giving up these threatening weapons and joining the international community. They can get what they need to develop and survive.
So it's a question of using it as a tool to achieve other goals.
That's right. Principally, tool. You know, the jury's still out on whether the North Koreans will ever give up that tool. It seems central to their approach to the world. But we need to keep trying. But I don't think anyone expects North Korea to drop a bomb on a neighboring country. But we do worry a lot about whether North Korea might sell nuclear material, nuclear technology to other threatening regimes. We know that the North Koreans actually built a nuclear reactor in Syria. It was never activated. In fact, the Israelis bombed it. But the real worry, I think, with North Korea is nuclear proliferation.
What do you make of the statement that the U.S., if the U.S. was to abandon its policy of hostility towards North Korea and a more trustful relationship emerged with the regime, that we might see a willingness to move beyond producing nuclear weapons?
Yeah, the U.S. has tried in a number of ways through the years to sort of convince the North Koreans that we're not hostile. In fact, in the last months of the Clinton administration, North Korea's number two official, Vice Marshal Jo Myung-nuk, visited Washington, met with President Clinton, and in that meeting they signed a joint communique which said explicitly that the United States has no hostile intent vis-a-vis North Korea. That effort to convince the North Koreans that we're not hostile was set back somewhat in the Bush administration, partly by the axis of evil comment, partly by other changes in our defense posture. So I think the North Koreans do not trust us. That lack of trust is one of the reasons they pursue these dangerous weapons programs. And you know, the question is, what do we need to do to assure them of our non-hostile intent? And I think the Obama administration, since coming in, has tried to underscore that point. Secretary of State Clinton, on her first visit abroad, went to Japan, Korea, and China. And said with regard to North Korea that, we're not your enemy. If you're prepared to give up these dangerous weapons programs, you can have everything you need, that you will have engagement with the international community. We will normalize diplomatic relationships. This is how we build the trust. Unfortunately, the North Koreans did not respond to that appeal.
What about North Korea as a society economically? How do you read it? Tragic? Underdeveloped?
Tragic in every way. They have experienced several famines in the mid-1990s. We think some 2 million people out of a population of 22 million died of starvation. This shouldn't be happening in the modern world. They need to open up. Just a little flavor, when I first went to North Korea to arrange the release of the helicopter pilot in 1994, we were driving from Panmunjom to Pyongyang when I looked up on a hillside, a snowy, cold hillside, and I saw large numbers of people digging, it looked like, with sticks and hoes and everything, and on the hillside. And I asked my North Korean escort what they were doing, and his first effort was one of bravado. He said, they're digging for seasonal delicacies at this time of year. We like these various roots and things, and that's what they're trying to do. As we were coming back 2 days later, after arranging the release of the pilot, we looked down and saw the same thing. And he said, I didn't tell you the truth the other day. These people, this is not delicacies. Our people are starving. They're digging up these roots and things because they don't have anything else to eat. And at that point, he asked me, he said, I've heard about U.S. Food aid programs, the PL-480 program. How can we get access to that? I think it was the first time the North Koreans had ever asked us for food aid.
You're a seasoned diplomat. What would your strategy be for negotiating now in 2009 with North Korea? How should we begin to approach this?
Well, I think right now we're in the North Koreans themselves are not in a a mood for negotiations. I think, as you know, the leader, Kim Jong-il, has been ill. He had a stroke a year or so ago. He was seen on television recently looking very, very weak.
Haggard, very haggard.
You know, there's a succession process going on within
North Korea. With one of his sons in the wings.
There seems to be, I think, you know, the son is only 22 years old. There's also a brother-in-law involved who might be some kind of regent. Obviously, he's going to need a lot of military support. And at the moment, he seems to be trying to demonstrate to his domestic audience that he's defiant, that he's successful in, you know, putting up satellites and things, that he's making North Korea a nuclear power. He doesn't seem to be in a mood for negotiations. So I think we're going to have to wait this out a bit. Obviously, negotiations remains the way to move forward. Military action is not a feasible option. No. Containment is not a satisfactory option in my mind either. One, it does nothing about the proliferation potential. And our friends in South Korea and Japan will be very uncomfortable if we seem to somehow acknowledge that North Korea is a nuclear power. So we need to keep trying and working at this. Right now, I think what we're doing and is the right thing, which is our representative is out in the region consulting with our partners in the six-party talks, trying to build up our coherence and our strategy so that when the North Koreans are ready to talk again, and I think they will be at some stage, we'll be prepared and be able to stand together.
Kim Jong-il is an eccentric character in so many ways, unpredictable, in some ways interested in life in the United States. He's been demonized. Have we played it correctly with him?
No, I think the Bush administration in particular made some major mistakes in sort of proclaiming the axis of evil. The president, I think, was quoted as calling Kim Jong-il a pygmy. Obviously, there are a lot of things not to like about him and that society. But to my mind, as a diplomat, if you're trying to influence one of the world's most isolated regimes, further isolation is not the way to go. What we're trying to do is draw them out in the world. So I think we should exercise more restraint. And I think we've been doing that since in the last couple of years of Bush. And I think the Obama administration has come in trying to use restrained language and to reach out to the North Koreans. And we need to continue doing that.
What about the New York Philharmonic going to Pyongyang?
That was the right thing to do. That is one way to give the North Koreans some of the respect that they seek. To hear, you know, the Star Spangled Banner being played by the New York Philharmonic in Pyongyang is a very moving experience. I saw Lauren Mazel just the other night at a Korean event. It obviously was a very, very moving event for the conductor of the New York Philharmonic. There is the North Koreans very, very much, at least earlier, have indicated they wanted to send their National Symphony to the U.S. We've been trying to encourage that in at least groups I've been involved with. And, you know, I hope the North Koreans, you know, moderate their behavior somewhat so that we can make that a reality. Because I think that kind of thing is we're trying to reach out to these people. We shouldn't be trying to isolate them.
I might mention that we've had some ovations to send some of our Jacobs School of Music people to Pyongyang. And we're giving serious thought to that.
I would strongly encourage that. One of my I don't think it was mentioned in my bio, but I'm honorary chairman of something called the National Committee on North Korea, and we would strongly support that. I'm also active with the Korea Society in New York, which is very supportive of these things.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah. And that's in regard to China's interest. Is it in China's interest to see fundamental change taking place in North Korea?
Yes, but I think China has two other, you know, important considerations. One is, they don't want as China to be promoting Korean unification because they like the idea of having some kind of buffer between South Korea and the U.S. military presence there and China. So the question is, how best do you maintain that buffer by developing, making North Korea successful, or by changing the regime? And I think they they see developing North Korea as the better way to do that.
I've often spoken with colleagues in South Korea mm-hmm. about the long term, about the future. Mm-hmm. Let's assume we begin to see a narrowing of the differences and maybe some reunification. I've often heard references to the German situation, mm-hmm. that the bringing back in of East Germany and relating it to West Germany had costs, mm-hmm. serious costs economically. Mm-hmm. The question of reunification then is not a simple one. Mm-hmm. Should it be done in stages? Can South Korea carry the burden of the economic costs of an underdeveloped North Korea as part of its mm-hmm. connection?
Well, I think every South Korean will say that they want unification, but not right now. They would like North Korea to be developed, to be civilized, to be in some way brought up to their standard. They would like to have a smooth transition into a unified peninsula, and one that doesn't threaten the both social cohesion of South Korea and the economic prosperity that they have achieved. And so one of their approaches to the North Koreans is to try to, you know, sort of build little entrees into North Korea. And one of them is a South Korean industrial zone built just north of the demilitarized zone in Kaesong, which has had, yes. had its ups and downs. Yeah. It's limited in the sense it's a bridgehead in the sense that a large number of North Korean workers are being exposed to South Korea and their ways of approaching things.
So the workers come
into the zone.
Into
That's
the
correct.
Zone.
That's
and,
right.
And then the industrial base is there for them to work in.
That's right. And so, you know, it is a bridgehead in the sense there's some exposure, but it's also very limited. The South Koreans are paying the North Korean government, which in turn pays the employees
right, exactly.
a lesser amount. They're not able to freely live there and, you know, talk. But each of these things, I think, helps.
But it is a bridgehead.
It's
a very good way of putting it.
Yes.
What's in it for South Korea to have reunification?
It's a national imperative for 5,000 years, and Korea has been Korea. And, you know, they can't conceive of it as anything less than unified.
I'd like to move to another area, and before we conclude, I noticed with interest that you'd been involved with human rights issues and democracy
right.
in Burma.
Yes.
I'd like to hear a little more about that, but I'd also like you to talk to us a little bit about human rights and where we mm-hmm. stand internationally in terms of the human rights issues.
Right, right. Well, I think human rights, the promotion of human rights and democracy has always been a central theme and an imperative of U.S. foreign policy. We've believed in that from the outset. You mentioned you're an expert on Southern Africa. You know, South Africa
yes.
is one of those places where it took time, but a
transformation took place.
A transformation took place, encouraged very much, I think, by the United States. And so, you know, the question in places like Burma or Myanmar or even, you know, human rights is important in North Korea, but I think we've concluded for, you know, the short run at least, that the focus needs to be on their dangerous weapons programs. And in Burma has been one of those places where our human rights policy came together. I was sent to Burma in 1994, shortly after we had concluded the agreement with the North Koreans by President Clinton to try to open up some level of communication with the very nasty regime they had there. I spent 3 hours with one of their top military leaders. I spent a good deal of time with government people and sort of laid out our approach to human rights and tried to start a process going which would have moved them out of their shell, hopefully, and carrying on. The United States is always torn on human rights between, you know, whether the priority is on taking a stand, standing up for this universal human right, or whether we should be sort of rolling up our sleeves and trying to take practical steps to bring about compliance. And I think with South Africa, eventually we did both. So far, with Burma, I think we have focused more on taking a brave stand for what is right than on actually kind of working with the Burmese and their regime to pull them forward. And I was somewhat disappointed after my mission in 94 that I felt the Burmese agreed to do about 60% of what we wanted them to do. But instead of sort of patting them on the back and saying, let's go forward, we chose to lambast them for what they weren't doing rather than to. So it's very hard in the United States with the pressures of public opinion and human rights interest groups to carry out a subtle policy combining, right. You know, the I think in Europe, too, eventually through the Helsinki process, we were able to, you know, both take a stand and get appropriate things done. I don't think we have a handle on that in Asia yet, whether it be China, where you know, you still have significant human rights issues in this now very powerful country, whether it be North Korea, which is incredibly isolated, or the sad case of Myanmar, which once was one of the, like the Philippines, right. One of the most successful countries, country with the greatest potential at the end of World War II, and has been dragged down by
a military regime,
by a corrupt and vicious military regime.
And of course, we always have to remember that all political situations are dynamic.
They're dynamic and they're all different.
And they're all different.
You can't take a cookie-cutter approach to different places.
And situations are never chronic.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you very much. I think a wonderful way for us to conclude the program would be to have another piece of music.
Great.
And given what we've been talking about and your diplomatic skills and knowledge, perhaps we should end with something from Dvorak, maybe The New World?
Great. Great. I remember playing that in my high school symphony orchestra.
Thank you. This is Profiles, and our guest today has been Ambassador Hubbard. Thank you for coming to the studios and for a frank and interesting discussion. This is Patrick O'Mara for Profiles.